Welcome to the first episode of No Nerds, No Problem. Today we're going to be chatting with Eric Mena, co-founder at Loper, talking about his experience building an edtech startup as a non-technical founder. We're going to be focusing on how they used a concierge prototype to get initial customer feedback before going into full-scale development of their mobile app. Enjoy the show. Welcome, Eric, to the show.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So Eric is a client of ours, and I'm going to try to pretend that I don't know as much as I know about their inner workings. So Eric, bear with me as I ask you some questions that you know I know the answer to.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so just to start off, I always like to start at the beginning. So tell me where Loper started. Where did you guys get the idea? What was that kind of initial ideation process like?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I'd probably even take it back to before Loper itself was an idea. Rewind to May or so of 2020, and the world's basically shut down because of the pandemic. And I made a decision to head back to the East Coast. I'm based out of Chicago, but head back to the East Coast and spend some time near family. And as part of that, I had to do a multi-week quarantine period. And so I actually had my co-founder at the now co-founder, but at the time, close friend from Georgetown join me for the 2 week stint that we had basically locked in a house in Rhode Island. And I would say that the ideation for entrepreneurship and education technology in general started then. I think Sam and I had a lot of time on our hands, and I had just transitioned into a new kind of break from my previous role in management consulting to working for an educational nonprofit. Sam has also always been impassioned by education. So we really just started realizing together there that we were both very passionate about the space, and particularly access and equity in education more broadly. We then parted our ways, went back to our respective lives. And I think Sam particularly took a lot more time to reflect on the space that he wanted to operate in, and particularly as he thought about his career, where he wanted to play and where he wanted to help society at large. And he ended up coming up with what is Loper today in concept while he was back in New York around give or take March of 2021. And he started engaging with me then about the idea of making it a full-on company and trying to do the whole startup thing, so to speak. And so I quit my job at the end of July of 2021, and August 1st was kind of Loper's true first day in form after Sam had spent a few months doing some, you know, customer research and market discovery work. And we've been, you know, running ever since on August 1st, 2021.
Awesome story. Let's actually back up real quick because I didn't ask you. Tell me about Loper. What is Loper? What are you guys building?
Yeah, absolutely. So Loper is a platform to help students discover their next learning opportunity. And what we mean by that is we've built a personalized engine that allows students of all kinds and backgrounds to dig into the things that they're looking for out of their educational schooling experience, the outcomes that they're shooting for, their interests, their constraints for their educational experience. And through aggregating all that information, our platform is designed to deliver them not only institutions and learning programs that suit their preferences, but also the really important details about those institutions for the particular student. So, James, I happen to know in your context that you went to Arizona State University. You are a computer science and math whiz. I instead am an international relations guy. For us, Arizona State University looks entirely different as an institution, and we have completely different interests that don't really overlap quite at all. And right now, the world is set up where it takes a lot for me to parse through all of ASU's information and figure out what's most relevant for me right as a future student. And so one of our big priorities with Loper is bringing that to the forefront for the student and making sure that it's highlighted from the very start where, for you, if you're interested in computer science and mathematics, then we're going to be directing you right towards those resources at ASU and cut the amount of time that it takes for you to go out and search for it.
Yeah.
The last thing that I'll add about Loper is that's our end state vision, to be a platform where students of all backgrounds can discover their next learning opportunity. We're intentionally starting really small in the narrow scope of helping high school students discover their 4-year college experience.
One of the things that I really loved in our initial conversations about the product, you guys use an example, I'm going to mess up the term, but these bubbles that develop around college awareness and how typically you're going to go to the school your parents went to, the school that's down the street, the biggest school in your state, and that's kind of it. When you guys described, and I'd love for you to correct my term, it was some, you used a bubble term, but when you guys described that, it was one of those like, oh yeah, like that's a problem, right? That is a huge problem that there's 2,500 schools in the country and I only know about three of them as your average high school student, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a couple of different ways to speak to that problem. So starting with where it's the most pressing, there is a huge resource constraint on counselors in the United States. The average student to counselor ratio in the United States is about 450-1. So you're imagining your standard college counselor, they're dealing with a caseload of hundreds of students. They don't get that much time to spend with a student and really dig into what are you looking for? What do you need out of your schooling experience? What are you hoping for when you walk out with a diploma in your hand? And as we think about that counselor constraint, counselors don't have enough time to become the encyclopedias right. that they're kind of required to be to introduce full transparency into all of the different options of the thousands of schools that exist in the United States. And there are a couple of consequences of that. First and foremost, students enroll in the wrong school. And transferring is really a massive burden on your typical student, and it can set you back multiple semesters and credits worth in terms of going into your new institution and having to graduate later. The other thing that it causes is it causes what I think you were referring to as regional bubbles.
Yeah.
And regional bubbles are where there is, within a given community, area of the United States, geography, there is a set list of schools that always seem to come up in conversation, and they dominate the space of the potential post-secondary options for high school students when they think about enrolling in college. I'll take, you know, my background as a Bostonian as an example. Boston University, Northeastern, Quinnipiac down in Rhode Island. There's dozens of schools just in New England that have a really, really strong brand recognition in New England. But in reality, those schools and institutions might be a great fit for a student out like, you know, like yourself in Arizona. And it just takes learning about it and getting over the hump of actually recognizing that the option exists to really start to widen the scope. The other thing that I'll mention on the bubble presence is that I think that there's a really large issue in the United States that people are starting to pay quite a bit of attention to, that the top 200 or so colleges and universities in the United States completely dominate the landscape. And for a lot of students, if you're looking to go somewhere that's not in that top 200, it is a really, really difficult and arduous journey to figure out what the institution is that would really suit your preferences and what you're looking for. And as we think about it, you know, all of those top 200 universities and colleges provide stellar educations, but that's not to say that 201 or 487 do not. Those rankings lists, while they take into account a lot of information, are at the end of the day relatively subjective in how they're approached. And one ranking list might look very different than another ranking list. And at the end of the day, it should be the ranking list for me right. as a student. It should be my personal rankings of what's most important to me rather than what someone else has told me is the be-all, end-all way of considering the list of colleges from 1 to 2,500.
Right, right. When I was probably 10 years old, I remember asking my dad, what's the best college? And he said, Harvard. I was like, well, I want to go to Harvard then, right? You know, like exactly. I'm 10 years old. I have no idea what I'm interested in. I have no idea what I even want to study, but I have to go to the best school. So that's the one I'm going to pick, right?
Exactly.
So you touched briefly on your background. I want to get into the validation that you guys did, because you guys did some really fun rounds of MVPs in there. But I want to talk to feed into that first. Let's talk about your background, your co-founder Sam's background, and how you were able to leverage that in this initial phases of the startup.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that I love to chat about. So Sam and I both graduated in 2018 from Georgetown, and we went our separate ways. I'll touch on him first. He went and he worked at a hedge fund in New York City. And I think he would tell you that there were two big things that he learned. The first was that he didn't want to be in finance for the rest of his life. And the second was that there are a ton of skills within trading specifically, which was the function he was within, that translate really well to a startup environment, which is really fast decision-making, mm-hmm. finding out information and going out and researching stuff to make sure that you feel conviction in the decision that you are making. And on top of that, juggling a lot of different things all at once and still maintaining a cool head and even breath as you're doing so. I had a little bit of a different career before starting Loper. I was a management consultant at Bain & Company, which is, you know, an international management consultancy. And frankly, I think Bain in a lot of ways is the perfect starter kit for an entrepreneur. I felt like I learned really, really hard to describe skills like abstract problem solving, the idea of creating repeatable processes that you can execute on again and again and again. I got a lot more comfortable with working with data and going out and figuring out answers to questions, which is a really big aspect of Loper's early days, was how are we going to actually do the things that we want to do for students? And how can we use data to make those like really informed decisions with conviction? So for me, I think more on the execution standpoint, and I think for Sam, it was the decision-making skill set that he learned and really the idea to think in the long term, but also always have the short term in mind.
Something you said there that I really like, the popular image of a startup founder. We get all these stories about the Zuckerbergs and, you know, the nerdy ones, the techie ones, and we get this idea, or the college dropout, even to go kind of the Theranos route, which, yeah. you know, let's not get into Holmes, but
yeah.
but this, you know, this image of like the college dropout, you know, like maybe a little off center, a little eccentric. They're tech nerds. They're just a little bit crazy. But the reality is that most startups are people coming out of industry that are leveraging some of the skills, techniques, connections that they made during that time period and leveraging that into your next endeavor. And so I love, you know, going from a hedge fund and management consulting into this education startup. If you've just been fed into by the, you know, the Entrepreneur Inc. magazine picture of a founder, that might not make sense. But if you hear the story and you see, oh, no, there are skills that I took from these, that you guys took from these professions and moved over, and they're so critical here. I think it's really important that people get that idea of there are so many different ways to be a founder and to be a successful founder.
Yeah, no, the only thing I'd add to that too is this idea of, particularly in consulting, getting exposed to things in short stints of time because it's a very case-driven culture and project-driven culture. And so for me, one of easily the most energizing cases I had in my entire time at Bain was working with a charter school district in a city in the Midwest. And we started with them in February of 2020, right before the pandemic really hit. And it was originally a five-year growth strategy case, which had me answering really big questions like, how do you decide where to expand and put your next school? Or how do you figure out how to do 10-year budgeting with, you know, fundraising goals that you're trying to meet over time? And it very quickly pivoted to, how are we going to educate a 2,000 plus student school district remotely, where most of these children, you know, unfortunately don't have computer access, they don't have smartphone access necessarily, they sometimes don't even have internet access. And so I was spending a lot of time, and I was staying up at night because I was so energized by it, thinking about what does the bus route look like to really distribute computers to all of these students? What are the pieces of this puzzle that we need to put together to make sure that there is still continuity in their education? And one big piece of that in general was this idea of college pathing and figuring out how to work with juniors and seniors remotely and make sure that they didn't get left behind as they were thinking about graduating and going on to those next steps. So I would add to everything that we just said to say exposure as well mm-hmm. was something that I'm really grateful for. There's a world where potentially if I had never been on that case, I might not have really found the passion that I have for education. I don't really think that that's true, but it's definitely a possibility at the end of the day.
Yeah, there's a, I want to say it's a Seneca quote, but it's an old Greek guy quote. And it's, I'm going to mess it up. Luck is 50% preparation and 50% opportunity. And I think that that's another thing is, if you are interested in the startup thing, you never know what's going to be the thing that triggers. Again, you guys were hedge fund and management consulting. You didn't go into DeFi or fintech, right? You guys went into education because of this other experience. So you got to be on the lookout, right? Always.
Exactly. That's right.
So let's talk about the initial validation you guys did, because I think this is the part, this is when you guys first came to us in December, maybe even November when we first started talking. And you told me years ago. Feels like a long time. The initial rounds of validation that you guys did, I think, were really, really creative, given your backgrounds and how you leverage them. So talk about what you guys did to kind of test this concept to really build your MVP and get it out the door.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite things to talk about in Loper's short life to today. Before I get into what we did, I want to preface it for anyone that's listening by saying I kind of believe in it, and it comes actually back to something I learned in management consulting. You should always be able to look at a version of yourself 6 months prior and see marked progress in where you've come, whether it's what you've learned, new skills you've earned, new relationships you've formed, across all of those different things. You should be able to look back and say, have I made progress in the last 6 months? And I had that from a mentor of mine at Bain that really stuck with me. So that's my preface of saying I'm very happy with what we did 6 months ago, but I've seen so much progress in our product since then. What we did at the start was we basically asked ourselves, what are the most important questions that we need to get answers to understand that this idea has legs? And for us, while we were continuing to speak with the customers who are the institutions in our business model at the end of the day, we really wanted to figure out on the student side, is there appetite for a more extensive personalized search experience for education? And as we think about the basis of our interface for our platform, it takes on an interface where students are actually swiping right and left on short form questions. And we wanted to test out whether or not that type of interface was something that grabbed their attention and maintained their attention throughout the matching process. So what we did is we stood up this really simple, lightweight, single page application through React. We put it in a MongoDB, and I can get super technical on what we did, but not really because I'm not all that technical. And we worked with someone on Upwork to basically go and build a front end version facing of the algorithm that I designed myself. And that had two big sprints within it. The first was, you know, with absolutely no design experience whatsoever, what is this product going to look like when a high schooler uses it? And that was really fun for Sam and me. I would say one of the biggest learnings is we need help with design, frankly, at the end of the day. The other big piece of it, which was something that, again, I think back and I fondly remember spending lots of time late at night trying to figure it out, was figuring out how can I match a student with schools and institutions that suit their preferences. And for me, the big learning opportunity there was going out and understanding what resources were available to be able to answer that question, whether it's public government data, whether it's privatized data providers that we now have relationships with that are feeding into our backend system. We stood up the single page application at the end of the day and tested it with a few hundred different students and saw that it did have legs and saw that there was interest in a version of this that was perhaps a little bit more rapid in the ability to deliver a match, but also maybe a little bit more robust in terms of the interface that we wanted to design. So it was a really good stepping stone as we thought about with engaging with No Nerds, where we could come to you with conviction and say, hey, we have this concept and we have seen in this field that this concept has traction. What we want to do now is take this concept and reinvent it so that we can scale it with a lot bigger of an overall user base and really start to get more intricate into the questions we're trying to answer for students.
Yeah, I love that you guys, I mean, scrappy as hell, right? Like, first of all, you build this model yourself, then you go and you get someone on Upwork, build the bare bones version of it, you go and you test it. And I mean, how did it feel to when you guys got that response? Was it vindicating?
Yeah, I think it was vindicating. I think Sam and I would both pay more attention to the feedback that we got than the positive traction. But if I, you know, think back to November and December when we were really doing these demos, the two best things that I heard from students, and I always go back to these as motivation to keep moving forward. The first was students saying to us, I didn't even know I was allowed to ask these questions about my preferred college experience. And what Loper does is it hands you, you know, anywhere from 150 to 250 right now is I think that the number that we're ending up at, different questions about what you're looking for in college. And we stagger it so that it doesn't feel like you're answering this long survey. Instead, it feels continuous with receiving matches. But when we went to students and showed them the depth that they could really think about personalizing and customizing what they were looking for, they were shocked.
Right.
And they said, no one really told me that I could be asking myself these questions. And then we went to counselors and they said, we've been telling them that they could ask themselves these questions for forever. They just weren't listening to us. So that was the first thing that was really validating and gave me a lot of conviction. The second thing was the idea of giving a student a school that they had never heard of or seen before and having them express interest in that school. And that goes back to the bubble point that you and I were right. talking about earlier. It is really hard to break those bubbles. They're formed over years and years of bias that exists within these communities. And when we went to a student and said, hey, I bet you didn't hear of this college that is in a city that was not on your radar, but offers these programs that are really well suited for you and these extracurriculars and this type of campus and facilities that all align with the profile of what you are looking for in your future institution, here is its name. A lot of students said, I had never heard of that school before and I'm interested. I want to apply. And that for me is like what it's all about, is introducing transparency at scale for students and helping them understand the full optionality that exists in general as they think about making that step out of high school into college.
One of the things that is difficult about Loper is that you guys are technically building a marketplace. And when I say marketplace, for people who don't know what I mean by that, I always think there's kind of this three classes of software. There's utilities, which are useful for one person alone in the room. It doesn't matter. There's networks, which need a group, but they really just need one group, right? So like Facebook is just people. There's not sides of Facebook, at least the original version. Then there's marketplaces like Airbnb or Uber, where we need drivers and riders. We need hosts and guests, right? And you guys, you're making a consumer-facing application. There's their high school students, they're still consumers. But you're also building a B2B business because you are selling into marketing departments at universities. So can you talk a little bit about the challenges around marketplaces, how you guys approach the two markets, the two users that you have to satisfy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think anything I tell you about this approach in general is I hope that I have a different and more informed answer for you 6 months from now when we do a rerun of this podcast. So marketplaces are really hard to build. And the reason that marketplaces are really hard to build is because of the, you know, ancient chicken or egg question. When you think about the fact that we are matching students with institutions, do we go out and we make sure we have a ton of institutions using our platform to market to students before we go and find students to actually be marketed to? Or do we instead go to students and build a bare bones foundation of what an institution looks like without needing their information and have students still be able to engage with that and then continue to build the user base and go to institutions and say, hey, we have this user base that we've been working on. Are you interested in joining in and perhaps even going to the level 2, level 3, level 5 of what it means to be a Loper customer? So that's the first thing I'd say about why marketplaces are hard in terms of how we have tried our best to counteract that age-old problem. What we are doing is thinking about what can we offer a student, because it's all for the student at the end of the day. And that's like the guiding principle for Sam and me. This is all for the progress of the student and to help them realize their best potential as a candidate. What can we offer them on our platform without needing the intervention of the institution? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of tools out there that do what we think is a more obsolete version of what we do today, where they have these, you know, archaic data sets of all the different colleges in the US, and students can go in and set these clunky filters and say, I'm looking in these 27 states. Oh, cool. Here's 2,000 schools for me to look at across these 27 states. So what we have tried to do is say, we're going to build a product that works for students without the institutions needing to be on it. We're going to grow our user base. We're going to learn from our students. What do they like about our product? What do they not like about our product? What else do they want that they don't currently have? And how can we even extend beyond this concept of colleges and universities into other types of schooling models, which is the end state vision for Loper? Offer that to them. And as we think about our short term and middle term, the priority is working really bespoke with a small set of institutions to say, this is what we are providing to students right now. This is what we are learning about students right now that you can actually leverage so that you can cater, personalize, and tailor your engagement with them as prospective applicants and get really, really intimate with them and their processes and workflows, understand how they're using our service and what they too would like to receive in addition to what they're already getting today, and do that on a small scale. And frankly, you know, hopefully succeed en masse on a small scale, but more likely than not fail a couple of times as we're trying to figure out exactly what our offering is and how it works best with those institutions, and then be able to recover with them and learn from it as we think about growing into a larger enterprise at the end of the day. And that's how we really approach our early partnerships with customers is, hey, we want to basically be there beside you at the table whenever you are spending time with our resources so that we can really learn what you do and do not like about our offering. And we can continue to modify it and improve it at a moment's notice for you because you are one on the short list of our customers for 2022 and 2023.
This is one of the places. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. This is one of the places where the Paul Graham do things that don't scale, I think, comes into play a lot with marketplaces or even networks. The more that you can reduce that problem from a marketplace down to a network or down to a utility, even, which it sounds like you guys are trying to do, right? You're trying to make Loper a utility for these students, even if the other side of the marketplace isn't present. This is where that mentality of, hey, I'm going to get in there and it doesn't matter that we don't have this data from institutions. I'm going to go find it. I'm going to go build it. I'm going to put together this data set. Later on, yeah, it'd be really wonderful if all of these places were managing their own Loper profiles and keeping their photos up to date and all that sort of stuff. But you don't need them there now. You guys can be the institutions.
That's exactly right. We can, I wouldn't necessarily say that we can be the institutions, sure. But we can represent the institution by aggregating all of the information that publicly exists for students across a bunch of decentralized sources and giving it to them in one fellow place in the palm of their hands, which is what every single Gen Z person is looking for these days, is something in the palm of their hands that they can engage with. And, you know, to your point, learn from institutions, hey, this is what we're doing. How can you supplement what we're learning outside of the conversations with you, with your individualized profile and what you really want to market and advertise to students? And by the way, how can we improve as an organization and serve you better? And let's make sure there's a constant line of communication on that in our early days so that as we think about scaling, we can make sure that we're doing it in the right way rather than having to address it in a really difficult and burdensome way later on.
So on the business side, because you guys have been pretty active there too, and I don't want to over-focus on the user side. You guys have been going to conferences. You are on the phone with potential customers all the time. Let's talk about the pre-sale process, because that's essentially what you guys are doing, right?
Yeah. We are in the pre-product pre-sale process of our relationships with our early customers. So it's been awesome. I think that the overall message here is particularly exiting the pandemic and getting to get on the road a little bit, talk to people about our vision, and something that I'm really, truly passionate about has been just really energizing day in and day out. And it's easy to get hyper-focused on something you can't do when you're starting a company, but these types of conferences and conversations with future customers are a way to really bring myself back and level myself and say, I know what this is all for, and it's all, you know, slowly but surely progressing in the way that I want it to. So what we have been doing is we have been going to these regional conferences that are consortiums for both admissions officers on the institution side and college counselors on the high school side. And they all meet and they all talk about trends in higher education and trends in college admissions. And it's frankly a silver platter forum for us to step in and say, hey, we're thinking about a new way of doing this overall search process. We hope that you'll stop by and listen. And it's been an awesome learning opportunity for Sam and me as we work with the awesome collateral that you've built at No Nerds for us, even before we launch our product next month, that we can actually show them on our phones and say, yes, these are the questions that we ask a student so that they can really dig into what they're looking for. And this would be the type of institution that they would see based on those questions. So you can see in live time really how this is and is not functioning in the way you want it to. And then that allows us to do two things. One, it allows us to garner interest and gain a brand presence across the board. We just had a follow-up conversation with an institution today from one of the conferences that we attended last week, and they're really excited about our driving actually down to the institution and having a second conversation with them in person. But it also helps us get feedback, before launch, which is the stuff that I think is really valuable too, where we have blind spots. I come from a management consulting background. My co-founder comes from a finance background. We think that we've gotten a really strong foundation of knowledge about the overall business that we're operating in, but we also know that there are questions that we might forget to ask students, and there are pieces of information that we might forget to provide on the institutional side. And so the really exciting thing has been advertising and advocating for Loper, but also keeping an ear to how people are perceiving our idea and have suggestions for improvement that we can think about on our overall product roadmap down the line.
Yeah. So something that I always think is interesting about the world is that there are conferences for everything, right?
Like, absolutely.
And you need to, the more specific you can be about your customer, which for you guys is obvious, your customer is obvious. For some people, it's not clear what the specific niche of the customer it is. Sometimes they think, I want to be a product for everybody. But if you can specify a group, even if it's just a group to start with, you can find a place where those people are going to get together and they're going to meet and they're going to be there for 72 hours doing nothing but talking about their jobs, right? So I remember I was listening to a writing podcast, and there's this fantasy author who writes, it's some alternative history fantasy about this small town, I think in Virginia. And there is a conference in that town for his book series that the number of people that come to the conference is larger than the number of people who live there, right? Like, I can't even remember the name of the series.
I know. I mean, it's just an indication of, you know, there are so many more things going on in the world than anyone has any ability to even theorize or consider. And more likely than not, right down the street, right around the block, there is some congregation of people that are meeting to discuss a shared goal or a shared mission or a shared interest. And frankly, you know, figuring out that these what are called ACAC conferences existed was for us like a huge learning to say, oh, there's probably a forum for that. Like when you think in general about questions like, oh, there's probably a forum for that. And we're trying to tap into that forum. And again, starting on a regional basis, but Nationals is coming up in, I think, the fall of this year in Houston, Texas. And you better believe that Loper is going to learn as much as we can from these regional ones and then hit the stage and the national one and see what we can do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And there might be local for different types of customers. I don't think there's a local meetup for college admissions professionals. But there's probably a local version of the conference. There's going to be a state version, a regional version, a national version. There might even be an international one. Start local, get your feet wet, learn the lingo, learn to get comfortable too. That's a big part of it. And then work your way up, go to the national one.
Absolutely. I mean, as we think about it, and particularly as I think about a lot of those classic frameworks that people discuss when they talk about starting a company, you know, the overall framework of test, iterate, learn, you know, build, measure, learn, et cetera, de-risking and consistently de-risking an idea. As I think about how we have perceived the last, you know, 7 months of Loper's tenure, it has always been about what can we get answers to provide us conviction in continuing to move ahead. And conferences in general and going to those regional forums that are smaller, but still hundreds of people attending that want to talk to you about what you're doing.
Right.
You know, those can be really great warm-ups and frankly, warm-ups in the deep end of the pool because it's still a really, you know, great opportunity for us to get a brand presence, but they can nonetheless be warm-ups to how do we want to tweak our messaging ever so slightly for the next one so that we make sure we resonate on this point that was a really big deal to the folks we talked to at the last one. And that's been a really great learning for me is basically, you know, acknowledging that a lot of the times I'm making, you know, strongly informed and convicted guesses. Mm-hmm. And the more and more those can become convictions that move out of guesses into, no, this is a true decision. This is something that I believe and it's our strategic direction has been awesome for me. And the regional to national conference transition is just an example of that.
One of the things you mentioned previously was that we have some collateral that we've built with you guys, but you guys are pre-product. It's not like you're showing up at these conferences with even a beta version of the app. We're very early still in the development process. I want people to understand that you guys are having hundreds of conversations potentially already that you've had. And you don't have the product yet, but you've done that because you're learning, you're making connections, you're making, you're growing your network and relationships. I just want to highlight for anyone listening that this is not like, oh yeah, we spent 12 months building something and now we're having these conversations. This is, we've just started building this. But you're out there having these conversations now.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, what some of the famous examples, there's a book called The Write It, and it's the author is escaping me right now, but he's a product guy at Google, and he focuses on examples of how you can actually, you know, show product without showing product, or show product without having product, so to speak. And one of the best that he provides is, what if you just make a landing page and run an ad on that landing page and see what traction you get on it? And I think in a lot of ways, we're approaching these conferences very similarly, where we have something way more robust than a landing page, to be clear. We have a clickable prototype that has the interactions that we want users to see. We do have, you know, it's not a full beta, but we have something that we can log into and see a very closed circuit version of our end state vision. And I think that there's two things that I've learned really generally in this process. The first is, get comfortable acknowledging that it's not complete and that you really want to talk to them about specific features that you are able to show them in the moment. And also listen for the stuff that they're saying they don't see in your incomplete picture, and see if it confirms what you're thinking is actually coming down the pipeline. And that's been something that's really awesome, as I think tangibly about our product. There are multiple times where we have engaged with college counselors or admissions officers, and they've said, well, hold on, does your platform do that? And we think to ourselves, it will. It's on the roadmap. It's not what we showed you right now because this isn't perfectly up to date, but you better believe that when this releases in April, it's going to be present on the platform itself. And that again provides us that you know, small loop validation as we think about the product that we're trying to release in April.
Yeah, if every time you show somebody what you're working on, and every time they ask, well, does it do XYZ, you should probably think about XYZ being present in the product, right?
Exactly.
Or in have general, a good just answer for why it's not.
Exactly. Or just in general, I mean, people talk about the importance of listening to your users, which is something that is really hard to get comfortable with. I think in general, like, you have to be comfortable with silence. You have to be comfortable with not leading questions. You have to ask super abstract, open-ended stuff and just see what someone spits back at you. So getting comfortable with that. And then on top of that, to your point about XYZ, or underneath that, excuse me, to your point about XYZ, thinking about, how can I quantify what I'm hearing in these, you know, fluid conversations, and how can I put some level of data behind how I'm going to take what I'm hearing from my users and make an informed decision about my product?
Yeah.
And that's been a really cool learning for Sam and me as we are in this pre-product phase in general.
There's so many validation questions I want, but we're already almost at 40 minutes here. So I want to talk about some other things. I will just highlight, Eric talked about the build a landing page, drive some traffic to it. That is something that you can do in a couple of hours with a landing page builder. You can describe your offer. You can get it on the web like with a click. And then you can spend like $20. I did this just to test it. I had an idea for a writing service. And I was like, I'm going to do this the low tech way. I built a page and a landing page. I spent $50 on Reddit ads. Because on Reddit, you can target subreddits. So you can target communities. And I targeted the writing community. And I got 30 signups in like 24 hours on this just random idea I had. And it was so cool. Because again, it took about an hour of landing page time. And then $50 on Reddit. And I knew that there was 30 people that were interested in this product. And I didn't know that the day before. So definitely
exactly.
Worth it.
And you know, there are no code versions of this, you know, that surpass low code, which is, I'll take myself as an example. You know, is there a community of high schoolers out there that exists in some random place that high schoolers hang out that is, you know, will open to my coming over to them and saying, hey, do you mind if I ask you what your college search processes look like? Or is there a community of recent college entrance, you know, freshmen in college that I can go to and say, what did it look like for you to decide to enroll in this institution? Like, tell me that end-to-end process. And people will inherently speak to their issues in processes, if you just ask them to describe it to you, usually people will focus on what's bad. And that's when you lend an ear and focus on what's bad and say, well, hold on, I think that this is what I'm thinking about making better. This is the solution that I'm thinking about. The solution that I'm thinking about actually addresses a lot of the problems that you've outlined for me. Mm-hmm. And that's like, anyone can do that. That was something that I had to get comfortable with,
right?
Was walking up to someone and saying, hey, like, do you mind if I just talk to you about this for a second? Or, you know, meeting someone I've never met and saying, hey, I want to tell you about what I'm doing. Anyone can do that. The first and most important thing to do is just get comfortable in what you're talking about so that you can really hold that conversation. But once you're there, go out, do it. It's the best way to keep figuring out what's next in the pipeline.
And if there isn't a community, if you can't find a conference, if you can't find a forum or a place online, consider making it. If this is really a group with like-minded interests, which if you're trying to sell to a market, it better be a group with like-minded interests, right? And they don't have a community. They're probably looking for one, right? So community can be a great kind of MVP, right? Does the market exist even before I ask, does my product work for them, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's right. And more often than not, you'll find that if there's a collection of people that really liked something or really didn't like something, they want to share. And that's one of the great things about being in such an information heavy society. There are obviously cons to that, but one of the best things is that it's really easy to share.
It's really easy to find people too.
Yeah, exactly.
We had another company that we worked with, Station Head, and we had an issue where the app kept crashing, and there was only crashing on one station, and it was the BTS radio station. It would crash on the BTS radio station because there's these BTS. So if people don't know, BTS is a K-pop, a Korean pop group that's insanely popular. I mean, just insane, like the level.
Yeah, don't age yourself by saying for people that don't know. I think everyone besides you knows BTS, James.
I don't know. I'm super lame too. So I'm like way out of it. But they organize these, like they'll go on YouTube or on radio shows, and they'll basically like bring down, like try to like raise the like count, try to raise the listen count. And so these little flash mobs, these BTS flash mobs, and it was killing this service occasionally. And it was, but the point is that there's millions of people that organize themselves online around a K-pop group. They're probably going to be organizing themselves around whatever it is, maybe not millions, and maybe they're not, hopefully they won't bring your product down, but it's hopefully worth, it's worth looking out there because there's a lot of places to meet online.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
So I want to talk a little bit real briefly about funding. You guys have done a lot of this work yourselves, but you do have to eat, and you have spent some money on external services as well. So where does the initial funding come from? What is your guys' view on fundraising? Do you have plans to raise more in the future? What's that look like to you guys?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's something that also, particularly for founders, is really opaque in understanding how it's done. So I'll first answer but with another caveat, like I classically do, to say the way that we did it is not necessarily the right way. It's not necessarily the best way. It's all up to really the decision of the person that's going out and figuring out, A, do they need money? And B, how are they going to get it? The way that we approached it, and this was after the single page application that we stood up in the end of last year, we essentially went out to a bunch of non-institutional investors and presented to them our value prop of, hey, we think that there is way too much friction in the high school student and college matching process in the narrow and short term, but also just more broadly in the matching process between students and institutions more broadly. And we had probably a couple dozen different conversations with folks about really generally the mission that we were outlining, our company vision, where we wanted to start and where we wanted to go after where we started, I think was a big point of focus for a lot of folks, is understanding that that vision was there and really seeing the vision that we had, but also making sure that we weren't speeding, 120 mile hours straight ahead to that vision, and instead being incremental in our growth. And so we closed out a angel round at the end of 2021. And we like to think about that as giving us somewhere between a year and a year and a half's worth of run rate which is really great for us. We obviously do spend externally. We have an engagement with you that we've been running and we expect to continue to run in some capacity throughout the year. And as I think about what that round did, it gave us the ability to continue to de-risk. And that's how we really messaged it to our non-institutional investors that started with us was, hey, we think that there is a vision here and we really believe and have conviction and we want to spend all of our damn time trying to figure this out. What this next 12 months for us is about is seeking and going on that long, arduous journey of, you know, ever called so-called product market fit, buzzword, but really going out and saying, how can we continue to de-risk this value proposition? And in terms of our overall goals, as we think about moving forward, I do expect us to finance again, potentially at the end of this year, potentially partway through next year. And one of the big learnings that we had from the last round was it takes a lot of time. And it's, you know, surprise, surprise, people don't want to just write you checks and say, okay, go forth and prosper. They want to really get down and dirty with your idea and what you're offering and what your metrics are and how you think about growth and yourself as a founder. And so as we really prepare for the next round, whenever it may be, I think we have learned a ton from the last in terms of what are the things that people care about and the things that we need to be really buttoned up on? And also, what does it look like to actually run this company while we're financing, which is a really, really hard thing to do where you can feel like you haven't made that much progress on your business because you've spent so much time asking people for money to fund your business.
Yeah, the amount of time involved, and especially I think it just gets worse too, right? Like at some point, you guys are going to be, you're going to have multiple employees, you're going to have multiple ongoing product threads and marketing and sales threads, and then you're going to have to spend 3 to 6 months fundraising in the middle of that, right? And like it's tough. It's really tough.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things where, you know, I will certainly say this about Sam. I hope that Sam would say this about me. I think that he would. I am immensely grateful for him and working with him because we free up a lot of each other's time. And frankly, there are things that one of us is better at than the other. And that's when, as we think about specialization in our roles, it becomes really powerful for us to be together as a team versus the situation where one of us was doing it alone, which frankly, I think would just be really, really difficult. And I don't know that we could get it done. He might have a different answer for you. You could ask him.
Sam's like, no, I'm doing everything. Eric's just free.
Something like that.
The other thing I want to highlight in there, just so that everyone's super aware, the single page application you guys built out was really a prototype, right? It wasn't ever intended to be a functional product. You guys didn't intend that to be a released product, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it was, you could go to our URL, you could easily go through the entirety of the lifespan of the user just from the, you know, from that one URL with no changes. And it was in full function a concierge MVP, where we basically allowed the user to experience what it was to swipe on these questions and detail their preferences and constraints for their overall search. And then we would go on the back end, import their data and actually run the matching algorithm and send them a personalized report via PDF of, hey, these are the institutions that fit your preferences. So in a lot of ways, it was prototype heavy, MVP light in terms of where we wanted to be. But one of the things that it really helped us learn, for example, is people didn't want to wait to get that college that felt like it suited their preferences. And that's why one of the big things that you and I are working on, James, is how can we have conviction in providing people institutions with continuity as they're actually answering questions? And what does it mean to match someone with less degrees of information about them than we are used to having from our previous demo? And that's been really exciting for us as well.
And for anyone who's not aware, Concierge MVP, what you guys did is the it presents itself kind of like the product. And then at the end, it goes, okay, cool, we'll get back to you. And then you guys go and do the thing manually. And you come back and go, okay, here's the thing that the product would have done, not us, if this had been a full-fledged product. But it's people get so caught up in the functionality. And to your point of kind of mini prototype, mini MVP, as you're sliding from that landing page idea, landing page and an ad, to a fully launched product that sells itself, you can sign up online, you never have to interact with a human being ever, there are lots of little versions of the product that you want to launch that you can launch on the way. It might be something that looks like it's working. I like to use the term Wizard of Oz, right? Like, don't look behind the curtain. There's a guy back there pulling levers. But hey, the experience, you still get to test. You still get to test this moment where these students receive this personalized college suggestion, and you get to get responses about how that feels.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think to visualize really easily a really good and simple to grab onto version of a concierge MVP, I forget if it was Instacart or a different grocery delivery service. The idea and concept started as, I'm going to collect people's email addresses and I'm going to ask them to email me their grocery lists. And I'm going to go out and buy their groceries and I'm going to bring them to their house and then I'm going to expense them for it. And he found, oh, it turns out that a lot of people want me to go and buy their groceries. So now I'm going to build a platform where people can just input these preferences and we're going to have shoppers on the other side that are handling all the things so that I don't have to do it every single time.
Yep.
But that's like a really, really tangible example of a concierge MVP. There was no platform that the user was using, but the entirety of the process still existed within the email chain and asking someone to send the person their grocery list. I can't remember exactly who it was.
If it sounds like Instacart, I know the story, but I can't think of it either.
Yeah.
Uber is another one. I think that the initial Uber app was text. You would text them if you were in SF and you were in their little kind of circle, you would text them your address and the car would show up. And them sitting and organizing with these livery companies to get these cars to show up. But it felt like a service, right?
And what did that help them test? Whether or not you're comfortable getting into a stranger's car without really having any context about where it's coming from.
Yep.
And they validated that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hard. So I don't want to hold you for too much longer. I do want to ask you a couple questions. First of all, I want to talk, as you guys have entered this world of tech, what has been the biggest surprise or biggest shock as you've kind of started building this product, dealing with devs, that kind of thing?
That's a really good question. I wish I had gotten a little bit of signaling that this was going to come down the pipeline.
We can come back shock. To it.
No. I like to give the live answer. I think the biggest shock for me is, I'll put it, it's a bittersweet and kind of a double-edged sword. So I don't have a robust technical background. I have some ability to work with data. I took a handful of computer science classes at my university, but besides that, I pretty much know nothing. And it has been a shock to me to see how well in some points I can tap into the development process and how poorly at other points I tap into the development process, where I'll use a really tangible example with you. You know, the idea of one of the questions that we ask our users with their regional preferences, that was something that I thought was going to be relatively easy to build because it's a pretty simplistic approach that a lot of platforms take. And then you came to us and said, this was a really big burden. This was really hard. And I was saying to myself, hold on, I thought this was just a simple question. But then you dig into it more, you learn what makes it difficult, and you start to see, oh, this is really intricate and not so easy for your standard engineer. And that was an awesome learning for me. Simultaneously, I have found that I can be more dangerous than I thought I could in technical conversations. And I would hope that that's something that you would say, where I really am learning the ropes of navigating product management and what it looks like to build roadmaps and think about features and functionalities. And I would hope that you would say that I'm doing a better job of that today than I did in the beginning of January when we really started our engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a great follow-up question. You talked earlier about how you guys were surprised to find out that you needed design help, right? And I think that's lots of people. You have tastes, right? So why wouldn't you be good? Like, you know what looks good. Why wouldn't you know how to make what looks good, right? Like, but I'd love to hear, because one of the places I always find with clients is a product that everyone, even people who don't think they're good at design, everyone thinks they can do product. And it's actually can be quite difficult. What's been your kind of experience learning how to describe your vision, learning how to get it, whether it was the SPA or the current product, getting it out of your head in a way that's transmissible? How has that process gone for you?
Yeah, that is really hard. And it's something that I would hope that a lot of people in products say that they're continuously trying to get better and better at, until this certain level of mastery where you start to like basically reach, you know, thousands upon thousands of LinkedIn followers because you're a prophet on how to do product management. And I follow all those people, by the way. So I would say for me in general, the tools that have been really helpful for me have been, you know, the platforms that have really become quite popular, like Miro and those kind of low code, simple visualization tools. Balsamiq is another example that I've tooled around with a little bit in the past because it's so low fidelity. And frankly, like being a little bit savvy and admitting that you need to figure out a new tool has been a big part of this, and saying like, okay, I can't build a phone screen in, you know, a strong prototyping software. Can I draw a phone screen on a piece of paper and make it pretty clear what I'm trying to do? And how well did that go when I handed that off to James and the team? Oh, they picked it up pretty well, but these two or three points were some, you know, miscommunications between what I was trying to say and what they received. So now I know that those two or three things are something I need to dial in more on the next time around. And that's why it's constantly iterative to figure out what works best for relaying information. And I would say the same exists between Sam and me when we chat. Sometimes we're having these super high level abstract conversations and we say, can we get a whiteboard out and talk about what this actually looks like on a phone screen? Because I am so lost right now. And that's when things start to really heat up and the temp in the room rises a little bit, because we start to work really hard together and collaborate. So that's the first piece. I would say the second piece that I am still working on is being concise and being very simple in what you're asking for and being very specific in what you're asking for. So there is, frankly, when you want it, as little room for interpretation as possible. And when you need, you know, that level of brainstorming, there's open-ended questions that allow people to not have a ton of context and instead just think from their own perspective about what they would do. And you all have a superstar designer on your team, Carolina, who is really good at flying at both of those levels, where I can say to her, hey, Carolina, I need you to expand this button by 50%, increase the font size by 2 points, and center it against this other object. And she's like, cool, bip, bap, bop, done. Or I can say to her, hey, Carolina, we have this concept of showing students, you know, let's take, for example, the weather at an institution. And I don't really know what this looks like. I think it's really important that they understand the weather today in the moment that they see the institution on platform. But can you brainstorm like where that fits into our overall screen, how we can best relay that information, and really those like bigger concepts? And even beyond that, Carolina, here's an idea for a screen. Here's the information I need to collect in a screen. Here's the information I need to tell the user in a screen. Go forth and prosper. And she has been able, your best designers I have found, and I assume this because Caroline is one of the short list of designers I've worked with, but she seems really good at her job. The best designers are ones that can do all levels of that and perform equally across all of those levels, because it means that they're true executors at the end of the day, where they can change stuff. But it also means that they're visionaries and can think really big picture on what you're trying to do. So that's been a big learning for me, is making sure that I'm always delivering my message to fly at the level that I want Carolina to fly at.
Yeah, it's designers like Carolina, not even just she is fantastic and we're very blessed to have her. Designers like her are, there's that joke in design, like, oh, well, can you make it pop? Right? Like, you know, it's like, but like a good designer, and not just one that's good at the execution level, but one that's good at the thought leadership level. Maybe not can you make it pop, but if you come and you go, hey, you know, just it feels clunky and the colors are depressing. That's not very, you know,
helpful.
But a good designer can go, okay, do you mean clunky like this, this, or that? Or do you mean depressing like this, this, or that? If we switch this to these three things, which one of these is less depressing to you or less clunky? It's important. It is important as a founder to know when you need to get specific and say, I want this button bigger. And when it's okay, if you have a partner, whether that's an internal or external partner that you trust, to say, hey, I'm sorry, the screen has got to pop. It's got to pop more, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say even beyond that, like, what are the emotions that we're trying to invoke in the user? And that's where Carolina is really good. How are users supposed to feel when they reach this stage? What are they supposed to pay attention to first, second, third? What does that prioritization of the eye look like? that whole world of attention spans and design is like a massive, massive body of work that people spend so much time becoming experts at. And it's really interesting to see how that process takes place.
Yeah, you know, one thing I'll just add, just because it's you touched on the iterative process of design, and I like to think of it always as kind of this upward spiral. One of the recommendations we always make, and we did it in the design sprint with you guys, is to start simple, to start with flowcharts, to start with wireframes, and to move up. Because one of the problems is if you start with design, you get this thing that looks sexy, because designers are good. Even bad designers can make sexy looking things. And you can look at the sexy design and you go, awesome, I've like been waiting to see this, but you're not even noticing that like it doesn't function. It's not, none of these flows make sense. It's got weird things over here that what do these buttons do, but they look cool. Starting with, like you said, with something like Balsamiq, anybody can design a layout in Balsamiq. It's designed for anyone. You don't have to be a designer. That allows you to do this upward spiral where you start with this low fidelity thing anyone can do, build up, but you don't have the misconceptions then, you don't have the miscommunication, you get a clear idea out, and then you can work your way up that ladder.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think about the number one thing that you actually told me about designers is designers will always add things on that they think are cool. You have to make sure that you can actually do the things that they think are cool. And that was like an awesome learning for us of, hey, Carolina, really, really good idea. It's just not something that we're capable of doing quite yet. So let's deprioritize that. And I'm going to keep it in the back of my head as a design standpoint, because I definitely want to go there. But unfortunately, we're just not there today. And again, it just speaks to how this is all an iterative process.
Mm-hmm. So last question, because I'm already at an hour and I don't want to hold you any longer. But any resources that you would recommend for other early stage founders, non-technical founders, maybe books, podcasts, videos, anything that you've found helpful so far?
Yeah, that's really, I think you're asking for my startup founder stack.
Yes.
I asked this question to someone a while ago and they phrased it that way. And I thought it was both annoying, but also awesome. So I think that there are like the books that people refer to as the Bibles of founding a company. The Lean Startup by Eric Ries, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is a really great resource for just teaching you how one way to think about this process. And I would put that book that I mentioned, The Write It, which I believe is by Albert Savoya, but I apologize if I'm wrong about that. It's definitely called The Write It.
Also, we'll add links to all of these, so don't worry about getting names or anything right.
That book really was helpful for me as I thought about going out of management consulting and what the mindset was that was required there, and going into founding a company and what the mindset that was required there was. Beyond that, I am a huge listener of podcasts. I spend a ton of time basically just intaking and inhaling content as much as I possibly can. And there are two podcasts that for me have been really helpful. The first is this one called Founder's Journal, which is by Alex Lieberman. He is the former founder of the news company called The Morning Brew, which started as a simple email newsletter about business and has grown into like a massive, massive company that I believe just got acquired by Business Insider. And he does these short form, you know, 10 to 15 minute long podcasts about like, how do you approach conflict when it's a team of three? Or what does it mean to actually have a really good business model that you can test versus a business model that's not that good to test. And he has really helped me like with critical thinking within founding a company in that way. I would say for the inspirational side, How I Built This with Guy Raz is like my go-to. I'm on a plane and I have a couple hours and I want to get deep with someone that really built something that I'm impressed by. I mean, the founder of Khan Academy, Sal Khan, who is, in my opinion, one of the biggest visionaries in education in general, has, you know, 70 minutes of pure bliss listening to how that guy thinks. And there's plenty of other versions of that, whether it's, you know, the founder of Headspace, the well-being and mental health app, or the founder of Wikipedia has a really awesome one about his inflection point of whether or not he should monetize Wikipedia versus make it a complete open source and free community. In general, How I Built This with Guy Raz, I use for those really big high-level questions about like, I'm thinking 5-10 years out, where do I want to be and how do I want to feel about the world that I've helped to create? Okay, am I on that journey? Am I always on that journey? And for me, Guy Raz is a really good interviewer and honestly gets a sweet slate of people to come in and talk about what they've done as well.
Awesome. All really great recommendations. We'll drop links to all of those. So anybody listening, you don't have to Google everything. We'll have it in there. Anything that you want to bring up before we go? Anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
No, I mean, I guess the two things I would say quickly, I'd be remiss to say, head on over to www.getloper.com. And if you're interested in learning more about our product and how we're helping high school students, definitely take a read through and subscribe for updates. And the other thing I'd say, you know, frankly, it's a promotion of your guys' work and what you do, but it has been awesome, particularly from someone with, you know, minimal technical background to come in and start working with someone like No Nerds who really takes ownership of tech stacks, but also in a way that a lot of, you know, outside studios do not do. You stay in the loop with us. You remain really engaged with us. You stay really communicative with us. So I think I've actually learned a lot from you, James, in terms of how I want this business to run as I think about building an internal engineering team. And for that, I'm super thankful too. So thanks a ton for having me on, and obviously got to plug NNNP at the end of it too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the kind words. Working on products like Loper is why we do this, why I do this. I don't know. I don't want to speak for Pato, but it's why I do this. And that's why I stick around, because it's fun. I mean, this conversation is fun, right? Like, I love this stuff, and I think you and Sam are building something really great. Hopefully we're going to stick around and build it with you guys as long as possible. So thank you so much for coming on. Really, really great resources. Really great story. I really appreciate you coming on, Eric.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, and we'll chat this week.
Sounds good. Yeah. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks, Eric.